Jack, welcome to the Roadman Podcast.
Good to be on. I've been a long time listener.
How are you, my friend?
I'm fantastic. My day's done for the day, so I'm just looking up at the mountains, enjoying my end of the day.
I'm looking forward to you illuminating the dark and grey misery of life as an aspiring pro cyclist in Belgium, and we can trade war stories in a little bit. But at the very beginning of this podcast, I'm aware that we do have quite a diverse audience base. So I just want to ground some terminology that we're no doubt going to come back to time and time again during this podcast for those who mightn't be familiar. Pro cycling has these three levels. The top is World Tour, which you're most are familiar with. Pro Conti, just under that. Most probably don't know the difference between Pro Conti and World Tour. And then we have a third rung below that, Conti. Depending on who you talk to, if you talk to World Tour guys, they don't really consider this pro. Average Joe Soap on the street probably does consider this pro. So it's somewhat of a gray area. I think it's safe to say that your expenses probably outweigh your income at Conti level. And that's why most people maybe don't consider it a pro level. Running on in our my kind of start here to ground it. Don't worry, I will come to a question eventually in this. The elephant in the room at the very start of this is you've written a book and we're going to talk for the next 35, 40 minutes about how to be a pro cyclist. And some would argue that you haven't actually made it to being a pro cyclist. I'm sure you've heard this criticism time and time again. So let's get this one out of the way so we can get into the meat and potatoes of it. How do you respond to that?
Yeah. So here's the thing. So I started writing this book 6 years ago. Like I started writing it a long time ago and I never felt justified writing it because in my mind, like the three goals of my career were World Tour, Tour de France, and Olympics. Like I wanted to do those three things. And until I'd done those, I felt like I wasn't justified to write a book on how to become a pro cyclist. And so I was just taking notes on it throughout my whole career because when I finished my career, I wanted to be able to give a guide for younger me to be like, this is everything you need to know in the one single guide because coaching is expensive and having great mentors is down to luck. And I didn't feel justified writing it. And I wrote the book and then the feedback was great on it. And what I sort of realized is where I was qualified to it is like, I agree. Like in my opinion, the like true pro cycling is World Tour level. And so to me, it's like, well, I only ever made it to the Conti level. But I do think I was unique in one area to give advice is I spent 5 years at the Conti level in Europe and like, or I spent 8 years at the Conti level. Five of them were in Europe. And as far as everyone else that I know, it's like most guys go to Europe. If they're not European, they go to Europe. They last at the Conti level for 1 or maybe 2 years. And then they go, either they make it or they quit and go home. And it's because it's so hard. Like you're just like barely trying to survive there. Like if you can't live with your parents' place, if you're trying to find places to live, it's really hard. And so I actually thought I had probably the most experience to teach it people the in-between parts. Like I don't know what it's like to be selected for the tour or walk in on the opening ceremonies at the Olympics. But if you want help figuring out all the in-between stuff, it's like, I don't think I had it any harder. I don't think I'm any better. I've just done it for longer. So it's like, okay, I probably figured out more of the roadblocks that a lot of guys would have to figure out. And that's why I just wanted to write the guide to help the next generation sort of navigate those parts.
But I also think it's important to say that even if you're listening to this podcast now and you don't have aspirations to be a pro cyclist, you're going to learn an awful lot from your journey.
Yeah, that's the thing. So I wrote the book to be like for a very specific audience. Like I was writing to 15, 20, and 25-year-old me, but the most people that have read the book and they've written the nicest reviews are people that have absolutely no interest in being a pro cyclist. Just like the life lessons and just like general stories. So the thing is, when I started writing, because I didn't feel qualified to write this book, I didn't want to put any of my stories in it. I just wanted to keep it to the information that was passed on to me because I was really lucky that I had access to so many of the best riders and coaches in the world. It's like, I'm just going to take all that information and put it into a guide, leave me out of it. Then I had to start putting in my story into it in order to make everything was chronological and make sense. And it turns out that's actually the part the majority of the people found interesting the most is just the stories.
And that's actually really nice that we can view this book and this conversation through two lenses, that if you do want to be a pro cyclist, yes, you can take something away from it. If you don't and you want to just look vicariously in on the journey of an aspiring pro cyclist and take lessons that you can apply to your own life, you can do that as well. Because also in this, there's a maybe on that surface level, we talk about the kind of wanting to be a pro cyclist, there's an underlying assumption that you know, you should want to be a pro cyclist, that that's something worth striving for, which is, it's maybe a separate debate, and it's one that with age, I've maybe changed my opinion on. I think it's how we define success. And if you look at some of the very top athletes in our sport, there's an argument to say World Tour has, it's become a very lonely place. The sacrifices needed to stay there, they're greater and greater each year. You know, Jay Vine on the podcast not too long ago, and the amount of days these guys spend at altitude away from family now, it basically rolls from one altitude camp to a race to an altitude camp. The season from the Worlds to Tour Down Under, there's such a small gap. It's not something everybody should aspire to head towards.
Yeah, I mean, so I agree with all of that. For me, it was a little bit different. So for me, like, I actually, like, my favorite holiday, it's like going to an altitude camp in Lavinia. Like, I love that. Like, that's fun. I love going to a place just to go train the house down and live like a monk. And I think especially, like, that's definitely the part that appeals to the 21-year-old kids as well. It's like, when your world is very small when you're young, when you haven't really seen other parts of life and all you want to do is focus on training, like that's the greatest thing ever. And that's, I love that. Like I still love going somewhere where I can just focus and live like a monk. It's not the time away from home that really bothers me, but actually like I still love the life of a pro athlete. Like it's, I think it's awesome. For me and what I hear from a lot of other guys, because a lot of my friends are and like old teammates are guys in the World Tour now. And for a lot of them, they all say it's like the danger part is the part that makes it not fun anymore. Like it's just, I really think cycling changed after the COVID lockdowns and like just the pressure got twisted up that much more. And then you had teams fighting so hard for points. And now the difference is the gap, I don't think the fastest guys going up the mountain are that much faster than they were 10 years ago. But the difference is the gap between the fastest guy and the 200th fastest guy is smaller than ever. So everybody's just as fast going up the mountain, maybe take away Primoz and Jonas away, them aside. Everybody's just about as fast going up the mountain. So everybody's making the differences on the downhills. And because the equipment has gotten so good and you have things like VeloViewer and you have guys just staring at their Garmin to look at the map on the downhill, to look at the corners, it's like you're really playing with the edge. And I think a lot, and I was the same way, when you're really young, when you're 21 years old and you haven't hit the deck that hard, or you haven't seen that many bad crashes, you don't realize like how big the consequences are here.
I was going to touch on that because the biggest thing that's changed, yeah, there's technology, but technology's always been moving. The biggest thing to change is actually you. It's your age. You know, if I still chat to, you know, guys that are one generation ahead of me, they talk about my generation. Oh, you guys came along and with these crazy risks. And then I talk to and I train with some kids who are like 17, 18, 19 now. And it's the exact same thing. They don't see any risk. They just see it as this is normal. I think it's us that changes. There's a great quote from Seneca, a man never walks in the same river twice because it's never the same river and it's never the same man.
Yeah, of course. And again, I have to be careful that I'm not the old man in this. And I would never tell guys to not fight. Like, okay, I'm 28. I'm not that old. But like, I completely get it. Like when guys say, when you hear like, yeah, let's say the older riders say they want to give advice to the younger guys and the younger guys just say, oh, like, you know, fuck off, whatever. And like, that is like I understand that. And I would never, like if somebody said that to me, I wouldn't take offense to that because I'm like, yeah, I would have done the same thing when I was 20 years old. Like they're just fired up. They want to fight. But it's just like, guys, like this isn't like football or hockey where like the worst thing that's going to happen to you is a concussion. Like there's real consequences here. It's like when you're going 100K an hour, bumping shoulders in the rain, and we can't really see where we're going right now. Like you're going, you go around some of the corners on like the Gavia and you're looking, it's like, there's no guardrail there. Like if you go over that corner right there, that's finished. You're going off the face of the mountain.
At least we got disc brakes now though. I remember going down the Gavia in the rain without disc brakes on carbon rims. You can't stop. You're just hoping no one else can stop.
Yeah, that's true. But okay, here's the other side of it. So I don't know if you remember this, but so Tour of Slovenia in 2022, there was one stage where we got rain on it. And why this was like unique is there was a funny YouTube video that was going around for a while that got a lot of clicks that was Pogacar yelling like, fuck these tires on the downhill. And like everybody was just laughing at this. I was in that race. I was in the group about like, you know, a few minutes behind or like 200 or 2 kilometers behind the human motorcycle, because we were going down this descent and it was like a hockey rink. It was so slippery. And because you have disc brakes now, guys are playing with the edge of traction with their tires so much more. And so the difference in tires makes such a difference. And we looked at the stage, the KOM results for like the downhill segment after the stage, and you could see everybody on Continental tires was all the top 10 on this downhill. And so guys are playing right on the edge of their tires traction. Like you're pushing it that hard on the downhills now. And it's like, yeah, okay, we're going to take even more risks now because you can really just
It's so scary. Like it's something I don't think that, and it's actually a nice place to start. I want to get onto the tactical advice in a second, but it is a nice place to start because from the outside, this is maybe what's entertaining. When you're on the inside or if you relate to somebody, this is somebody's husband, this is somebody's son, this is somebody's brother, this is somebody's sister that are taking these chances. And safety is something we should take seriously. There's a race out your part of the world, Tour of Beauce. And I remember coming down a descent on that in the rain, just completely straight descent, looking down at my speedo and I'm doing 112K an hour and seeing this one kid beside me hitting what he thought was a puddle and it turned out was a pothole. I haven't seen the kid since. I can only assume he was vaporized. Like I don't have no idea what happened to him. Gone. But you hit a pothole at 112K an hour, it's not good. Like, I don't know if he went to hospital in a helicopter, but it's not good.
MyWoosh is hands down the best virtual cycling app for home, and it's redefining indoor training at no cost. Yep, it's absolutely free. And setting up MyWoosh is really easy. Just download the MyWoosh app. Connect your device like your Watt bike or your smart trainer and off you go. Now, if you're feeling competitive, there's weekly races for every category from beginner to pro. Plus, there's insane prize money up for grabs. Now, if you've no plan to race, that's no problem. There's hundreds of free training plans and workouts that are designed to really push you to your limits. You can enjoy daily group rides and group workouts, and you can customize your avatar all without opening your wallet. So go on over to the MyWoosh app and have a look around. Why spend money on monthly subscriptions elsewhere when MyWoosh offers all of this for free? So join MyWoosh today. It's available on iOS, macOS, Google Play, Apple TV, or click on the link in the show notes to get started.
Yeah. No. It's, here's the thing. It's like as much as there's like a bit of a gray zone where I actually think it's the most dangerous. And I think actually at the very highest level, like the World Tour level teams, it's the guys aren't quite as desperate for that. So, but because they're paid real salaries and it's like they're not willing to risk their life for it. It's more, I find it's actually even maybe more dangerous at like the 0.2 level races or in some of the Grand Fondos where like I've only done like maybe 3 or 4 Grand Fondos in my life and they're super fun. They're great. But then you see like guys, because they're allowed to super tuck in the race and you see some guys super tucking on these downhills. But it's like they go around the corner like a boat and you're just like, man, like I can't watch this. Like it's like a grenade that you want to stay away from. And like, I get it. Everyone wants to go fast and you like feel cool and stuff like that. But I don't know if you have the skills to pull this off right now.
Yeah. Talk to me about frameworks, Jack. I love the idea of frameworks because there's something like a yellow brick road about it. Like if I go into the dentist and my outcome goal I want is to have clean, straight, white teeth. The dentist doesn't just tell me to do one thing. He doesn't just say, hey, just brush your teeth and you're good. He gives me a framework, like a recipe. He's like, you know, brush twice a day, floss once a day, come back once every 2 months for a whitening and a checkup and a root canal or whatever his framework is. And that gets me the outcome I want. If the outcome I want is to be a professional cyclist, how do I start approaching this framework question?
Yeah. Okay. So this is literally the whole book. So I've thought about this quite a bit. So I mean, okay, here's the keys that you need to know. The best rule I can think of is to build a great team of mentors. So you need to build your team of mentors who to learn from, and that's the best resource you'll get. And for me, it was 4 guys. It was Swain Tuft, Paolo Saldana, Kevin Field, and Mike Creed. And those were guys where I just realized that I'm very stubborn. I'm bad at listening. So when they speak, I'm going to shut up and just listen. And so
Swain's also, I've had him on the podcast a couple of times.
Yeah. Swain is outside of, that guy has given me, he's like family to me. He's really been unbelievable to me. But build a great team of mentors. Learn how to ask intelligent questions and reach out. Because like also I've had like Chris Froome and Annemiek van Vleuten were both like 2 people that gave me so much of their time. And like invite me to go training, like spend time with the, answer questions. Like, all, like I never thought I'd even speak to these people. Like I was so nervous to even be around these people and they're giving me all this advice. And like, they're really, if you know how to ask intelligent questions, you're respectful, you don't ask for favors, like you would be amazed at how much help you can get from people because they know what it's like to be chasing that dream. That's the first thing.
So just to get tactical on that, this is intimidating as, you know, cycling's changed a lot, even in, you know, from my generation to yours, it's changed quite a bit because you could be a pro cyclist at 27, 28, no problem. Or you could even start your career at that age. Now, you know, you're 28, which you respect, it's going to get more and more difficult for you to step up to the world tour at that age. You're looking at kids now at 17, 18, making that step and signing development contracts. At that age, how do you start cultivating mentor relationships? Are you cold reaching out to people on social media? Are you trying to engineer your way into their group rides or what's your process?
Yeah, to reach out to mentors, I would say, yeah, just be willing to reach out. And not everybody's going to give you an answer, but you would be stunned at, I mean, okay, so with Chris Froome and Anna Meek, for example, like those are two really big stars. And so the way I got in contact with them is I was invited to a training camp with Chris Froome and with Anna Meek. I happened to be at a training camp and she was also there and she just invited me to go training with her a couple of times. So it, like I, those weren't reaching out on Instagram, but with a lot of pros, it's a lot of just reaching. If you can get in contact with them, as long as you know, like I would say, yeah, reach out to that way. I think that's, as long as you're respectful, you're humble, it's like, hey, this, because they understand what it's like. And you would be amazed at, they will give a young athlete more time, like when it comes to giving advice, often more than a journalist who could actually do something for their career. Like a journalist that's going to write a nice story about them, they're probably going to be less motivated for that than to help a young kid because they remember what that was like.
So that's your first thing you would do as a kind of an aspiring. What's our next step?
So have a great team of mentors. That's the first thing. I mean, you got to get to Europe as soon as you can. That's like, it's a different sport. And whether you're coming from Canada, the US, Australia, any of that, like it's unfortunately, you do have to get to Europe. A very big thing. And so I talk about this a lot on my podcast is just talking to other pro cyclists and getting, asking them basically the question you just asked me, like, if you miss that cutoff, if you miss that under 23 cutoff, how do you make it now? And the reality is it used to be the biggest step in pro cycling was the jump up to the World Tour. Now the development teams are so good that the bigger step is actually from the club teams to the development teams, because the development teams are basically World Tour now. Like you look at the best under 23 and junior teams, it's basically a World Tour team. So if you miss that pipeline, it's incredibly hard to make
it.
Can
I push back on the get to Europe point? I do think it's important to look for signals of success along the way, because we're seeing this duality emerging where you're seeing a lot of riders who live in a little bit of a vacuum where they have all the nice kit. They like rolling to the coffee shop. They like getting their Cat 1 race license, but their kind of identity is built on training a little bit harder and a little bit smarter than some of their peers and beating up on guys who aren't at their level. They're like a, I had a gangster on the podcast and he had a brilliant expression about being a gangster. And he said, everyone wants to be a gangster until it's time to be a gangster. And I just think that's so applicable to cycling as well, because everyone wants to be a bike rider until it's time to be a bike rider. There's a difference between being the Cat 2, Cat 1 guy who wants to pose and wear a good kit and being the dude who's stuck in an echelon in a race in Europe. Not everyone is cut out for the second life. So I think you do need to look for signals of success to get to Europe, or else you're going on an extended, you know, Erasmus here where you're going away for a gap year and not really aspiring to be a pro cyclist.
Totally. Yeah. Really, okay. So I guess
separating the dreamers, I suppose, is what we're trying to do here. Like the dreamer filtration.
Yeah. And so I guess I sort of skipped a step there. So the nice thing about cycling is it's very easy to see, like if you have like the physical engine to do it. And it, just like an example I'd give is like 2018 was my last year racing in North America. I had a good year there. And by the end of that year, I was talking to five different World Tour teams and all of them said the same thing. It's like you have the engine and that the results in North America to show you belong at the highest level, but we need to see it in Europe, because the two things they're looking for in Europe is, one, do you know how to race your bike in Europe, and how are you going to adapt to living in Europe? And I thought that was crazy at the time. And then I went to Europe and I realized how right they are. So it's like, if you really want to make it as a pro cyclist, it's like, you got to make sure, like, don't be delusional. You do need to make sure, like, you are strong enough, you're fit enough, like, you can handle this stuff. But you also need to understand, if you're not from Europe, the harder barrier for you is you need to go now rebuild a whole new life in Europe. It's like, right now, if you're a young kid in North America, wherever, it's like, you're doing these amazing power numbers in a very comfortable environment. Maybe you're still living at home where the fridge refills itself and you don't have to pay rent. Like, now go rip up that life and go do it in Europe where you have to handle all that stuff as well.
And the thing is, with these riders that do make it, like, I came up racing with Sam Bennett, who's, you know, famous for being a super fast finisher now. But at a lower level, you're not a fast finisher. That's not what Sam Bennett was. Sam Bennett would win hilltop finishes. Like, Sam Bennett would rip you apart on a climb. Like, again, I got to race Mike Woods quite a bit in North America. Woods, he's known as a climber now. He'd ride you clean off his wheel on a flat road. Like, they're not specialists. Some people lean on that, I think, too early and say, oh, I'm a breakaway specialist. I'm a sprint guy. At the lower level, you've got to be the best at everything, because when you step up to that bigger pond, you're pulling from countries all around the world into this pond, and you're going to just, you know, be exposed to talent like you've never seen when you get to France, Belgium, Holland.
Yeah, absolutely. And a big part of that is, like, when you're still learning that, because it's great to have big dreams and whatnot and try to learn. This also comes back to, like, having those mentors, right? Like, everybody loves to give advice in cycling, and everybody has great intentions. But the reality is, some people just might not know what they're talking about. And so you need to really evaluate your mentors and be like, okay, has this person actually been to the highest level? And, like, are they qualified to basically give me advice on this? Or are they just, there's going to be some people that want to help you. They want to give you advice, but they just might not know what you're talking about or what they're talking about. And so they might see you win a gravel race in your home country and think you're going to win Paris-Roubaix. And you're just like, yeah, I mean, you know, like, if you don't know anything, if you're brand new to the sport, if you're 15 and you're like, that's great. You're like, oh, I'm going to win Paris-Roubaix. This is awesome. Like, so-and-so at the local group ride told me this. And you're just stoked because you don't know any different, right? Like, that's hard. Yeah. When you're just starting, you don't know the difference between who knows what they're talking about and who has the right intentions, but just not the right qualifications.
Yeah, I'm on board with your step so far.
Yeah, so those would be the first ones. And then, okay, here's probably the most important thing. And this is the biggest lesson I learned from Swain. So maybe you'll appreciate this. So yeah, Swain Tuff was my biggest mentor. I'd say after my mother, that guy gave me his time, like, spent way too much of his life on the phone with me, gave me equipment, money, like, everything. And the biggest thing I took from him is he has a tattoo on his right arm that reads, "We will never be here again." And what I learned from him was to just appreciate this special time when it's all about you and you get to chase your dream. And so that's like, is brutal as it is to try to become a pro cyclist, like, it's grim, right? Like, you're going to do some of the most impossible races nobody's ever heard of. You're going to be, you know, covered in road rash and having to finish the race. And it's a really hard life, but you have to look at, you know, this is a special time in your life where everything is about you. You don't have to, you have the freedom to chase your dream. Maybe you don't have as much money coming in, but, you know, the next chapter of life, like growing up and becoming a grown-up, if you don't make it, that will come. And that chapter of life is awesome, but just appreciate the special time. Because Swain was, I mean, he dropped out of high school to be a homeless bum riding a thrift shop mountain bike around North America to go mountain climbing. And at some point became a pro cyclist. And he talks about, like, that was the happiest time of his life because he had no money, he had nothing, but he could sit under a tree and read a book for a while. And with me, it's like, well, I'm traveling, you know, just appreciate this special time in your life where you're free to chase that dream.
And I think you can also, you don't need to be insecure that your friends are getting houses, starting relationships, buying cars, and you're still making 50 euro a week racing for a French DN2 team. Once you decide to go back to the real world, you can flick the switch pretty fast. You can build that life pretty fast. So the idea of being jealous or FOMO, fear of missing out, I don't think should play a factor in it.
Yeah. And so here's the thing. It's like, if let's say you've been trying to be a pro cyclist since you're a teenager, when you were 15, 16, 17 years old, everybody in society viewed you as the successful one because you're the one getting up at 4 a.m. to go training before school. You're the one not partying, not drinking, not smoking, focusing on your training. Maybe you get to race for the national team. You get to do the world championships. Like, you're king of the hill. By the time you're 25, if you still haven't made it, other people have now surpassed you that were drinking and partying and doing all this other stuff. And now you're looked at, or you maybe look at yourself. I can only speak for myself here. You look at yourself almost like a failure because everybody else is driving a new car, buying a house, getting married, all this kind of stuff. And you're like, what the hell? Like, I've been working so hard my whole life and I got nothing for this. And that's the draw that pushes guys to move out. But the way that I looked at it is like, okay, what's the worst case scenario here? If I wake up at 30 years old, I never made it. I work my butt off. And now I get out of the sport. I got to start chapter two of my life and I have no money. I have nothing. It's like, I can at least live the rest of my life knowing that I gave it everything I had for that. I got to travel the world. I got all these upsides to it. Like, that's not so bad to have to start chapter two of your life at 30, but I know it would absolutely crush me if I gave up at 26, 27, and then I move on to the next chapter of life. And then the vision in my head that was just burned in my brain that scared me so much is I'd be 31, 32 years old. I'd be in my new life. I'd be watching the Tour de France 1 year. And like, you know, I'm 3 or 4 years out of the pro cycling world and the Tour would be on and it'd be some guy winning a stage at the Tour and he's like 31 years old. He just got his Neo Pro contract and it's like the feel good story of the Tour this year. And that would
Michael
kill
Vink.
Me. Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Someone like that. And like, that's amazing. Like there's a guy that just didn't quit. And I loved the podcast you did with him. That was awesome. Like such an inspiring story with him. It's like, there you go.
I love that idea of worst case scenario because the worst case scenario isn't that bad, you know, barring a crash or anything like that. The worst case scenario of playing this out until you're the age 30, 31, 32, it's not that bad. You can start your life, no problem. I do think you need to balance that with having the EQ to know when enough is enough because it starts chipping away at your mental health and away at your confidence. Like we talked about that idea of, you know, a filtration system to stop the dreamers from the kind of prospects at the very beginning. Some sort of advanced or amended version of that filtration system, I think, needs to be reapplied every year where you say, is there signals of progress here? Am I moving forward? Am I more likely than I was last year? Because if you're regressing season on season, you know, what are you doing? Because I think it's undermining that confidence you have then to start that next chapter, which isn't a hard thing to get started if you come to it in a good headspace. But if you come to it as a broken man, it's a difficult thing to kickstart. Road men, I'm going to date myself here, but I've been riding the bike for almost 20 years. And in that time, I've cycled through every cycling apparel brand out there. And I kept swapping out different apparel brands each season until I found Lacoste. There's something really different about Lacoste. And as soon as you slip into the gear, you notice it feels different. It feels better. I've had the pleasure of chatting with Yanto Barker on the podcast. He's the Lacoste founder. And his dedication to crafting the fastest, most refined cycling apparel out there, it's nothing short of inspiring. Yanto isn't just trying to create gear. I get the feeling he's actively and obsessively trying to perfect cycling gear. Trust me, as soon as you slip on the Lacoste kit, as soon as you zip up that jersey, you can feel that commitment. The proof for Lacoste, it's in the pudding. This is the same kit that Jay Hindley wore when he clinched overall victory in the Giro d'Italia. There's a confidence that comes with wearing apparel that's been battle tested and podium proven in races like the Giro d'Italia. Trust me, feeling good on the bike means you're going to perform better. If you have a second, I highly advise you to jump on over to lacoste.cc and check out their amazing range kit and experience this feeling for yourself.
Yeah. Okay. So actually, I love this. And so I don't know if you know who Alex Hormozi is, but this is a guy that I've been following a lot on all his channels. I love his content. And he has such a great quote where it says, he says, it's like, confidence is not, you don't shout affirmations in the mirror to have confidence. Confidence is having a stack of undeniable evidence that you are who you say you are. And the nice thing about cycling is you can see stats every year. And if you do have to like make sure you're not delusional, right? Like it's not just hopes and dreams. Like you do need to have evidence that you are good enough. You need to show something every year that you are making progress, like have some sort of hard stats there. And then again, going back to like the mentors thing, you need to have a couple mentors that know what they're talking about and they're not afraid to hurt your feelings. And for me, that was Swain and Annemiek, is like, they were not afraid to hurt my feelings and tell me like hard truths at points. But the nice thing is, it's like when they give you a compliment or something like that, then you know it matters. It means something as well. Because, you know, mom will always tell you to keep going, but like mom might not know what it's like to be a pro cyclist.
Where does Matteo Jorgensen's philosophy kind of fit into your framework? Matteo Jorgensen, the way I've looked at him is he's treated himself slightly different to other athletes. He's looked at himself more like a founder looks at a company, where he's looked at it from an ROI perspective and investments into himself. So he started investing, you know, into advanced sports science, physiological tests, aerodynamics, equipment at an earlier stage than we would typically see.
So I can actually talk, this is hilarious that you said this, because I have a whole chapter in my book called Matteo Jorgensen, because we were teammates. And it, like, so he's an example, like he's such a great example of this, because Matteo and I were teammates in 2018. And so like, I can say a lot about this, because what I remember about Matteo is when we were teammates, like he was nothing special physiologically, like he was really average. And, but what he stood out with is he absolutely made the most out of the things that he could control when it came to like studying bike racing. When you would talk to this guy, it sounded like he'd been studying bike racing since he was 3 years old. And then the thing is, we were teammates in 2018, but we barely saw each other because he was always racing with the national team over in Europe. He was going to Europe with the national team, getting that exposure early. And I didn't get, like, the next year, 2019 would have been his first year living in Europe. We both made the jump to Europe that year in 2019. I struggled a lot. Like, I had all the physiological numbers and all, like, I thought I would do well. And he was killing it. Like, he had a great year there because he had learned how to do all these other things. Like, he learned how to speak French right away. He knew about all these races, like these races that you've never even heard of, that I'm thinking about, like, what are these races? I don't know anything about this. Like, he made the most of that stuff. And then you even talk to, I don't know how much of this I can say, because it's like, it's not really, like, I don't know if Matteo would want this like public, but like talking to some of his teammates, for example, on like past teams he's been on, like the guy would invest in like the sports science stuff in his recovery, like spend a lot of his own money to invest in stuff to make his training that much better. And, you know, he spent a lot of money doing that, and now he's on Jumbo. Like, Matteo to me is the example of a guy that did not have any sort of physiological super talents, but made the most out of what he had and really executed that stuff well. Like, he was left off Action. The weird teammates in 2018, he was supposed to get a contract on Action and they didn't sign him because they didn't think he was good enough. It's like, he killed it. Like, clearly that fired him up to make it.
Let me throw a curveball on this one. Do you think there's a role for new cyclists in building personal brand in tandem with the normal traditional route to being a cyclist?
What do you mean? Are you talking about like influencers making their money in the sport?
Yeah, I'm not quite talking about influencers. I'm more talking about, you know, Sagan obviously propelled 100% and specialized for over a decade, but he had talent coupled with brand ability. But if you take a rider, which I don't know if we have any riders doing this very well at the moment, but in other sports we do, where there's a level at Continental where a lot of Continental riders are roughly the same ability, given the right environment. Like, if Jumbo signs one of these guys, they're going to make it into the World Tour. What separates the rider A from rider B? Like, what's the considerations a team weigh up? Well, they're obviously going to weigh up physiological stuff, potential. But I'm wondering if one rider has built a huge personal brand as well as, so it's you and another rider who's your clone, but you've built this huge personal brand of hundreds of thousands of Instagram followers. All of a sudden now you can sell products, you can sell tires for sponsors, you are becoming a commodity as well. Is this the way we're going to see cyclists develop, this sort of tandem value proposition? Yes, I'll get your results, but also a realization that general Joe Public really doesn't give a shit who comes top 10 in, you know, some men that we were talking about earlier. Like, they don't even know what these races are. You know, outside of the classics, the Grand Tours, you know, unless you're a very, very 1% hardcore fan, you don't understand these races. But you do understand the cyclist on Instagram who has 300,000 followers.
Okay. So if we're talking World Tour, like pro road cycling, is that what we're going to stick to that example? Because I think it's different. Yep. So if we're going to talk World Tour pro road cycling, if you asked me this question 5 years ago, I would say, yeah, there's some guys that can get contracts because of the social media following. I would say now, not anymore, for two reasons. One, the teams, on the team side of it, they have so much choice for stars that are just so good that they don't care about that as much anymore. And on the rider side of it, like, I don't know any riders that are at a high enough level to be competitive at the world. Like, the level is so high. I don't know anybody who's that good at the highest level that can also manage having like a big personal brand, like having a channel on the side. Like, I'm not going to name them, but I can think of some examples, and it's like, they're just like, you'd get killed. Like, the World Tour level.
Keegan Swenson is the one that jumps into mind straight away. Keegan has a personal brand. would Keegan get the nod over somebody who's comparatively talented that's European?
No, I think they would just look at the results. I think Keegan's doing an amazing job like representing the brand there. And I think it's smarter for him to stick with doing what he's doing because he probably makes more money with that.
Yeah, he definitely does. Yeah.
Yeah. So if a World Tour team is looking at Keegan versus some no name other rider in Europe, I think they're just going to look at stats. Like, I don't think the Instagram follower stuff will come into play there because it's just, I don't think they need it. Like, the level is so high at those races there. Like, it's, I don't think that, and it's sometimes,
but
it can
be wrong because you look at how broken the model is in professional cycling, like sponsoring a pro cycling team. It's not sponsoring a pro cycling team, really. It's philanthropy. There's no return on investment for these sponsors.
Totally. And so I think if Keegan wanted to be in the World Tour, they would, like, the team would only be judging him based on his results. And if a team wanted to work with Keegan, they would probably have him doing something like what Lachlan does, where it's like, hey, we'll pay you a salary, but like, we're going to get you to do like exposure stuff. We're going to leverage that part of you. Then we're not going to throw you in the races. We're going to use you for what you're good at there. But like, it's so messy with different teams because you look at, like, for example, like Red Bull on some of these teams. Like, I think there was some athletes, like, you couldn't be a Red Bull athlete on one of the World Tour teams because that World Tour team didn't want to allow some of its riders to have a different kind of helmet, like a Red Bull helmet on. And so that team basically like almost kind of shot itself in the foot by saying, you're not going to have one of the biggest sponsors in the world come in because you want to have all your riders have similar looking helmets. Like, it's just like, it's messy versus now you look at Bora, like they're going to get Red Bull as a title sponsor. Like, that's insane. Like, to have a Red Bull team at the Tour de France, like, that's cool for the sport.
Yeah, this might seem like a detour for listeners who are wondering about, you know, being a pro cyclist, but I think it is interesting to hear this insider perspective from you on what team owners value, because then we can calibrate our actions according to those values.
Yeah, I would say it's like the level is so high now. And so here's the other thing. The pipeline feeding the World Tour, like the pipeline of talent going into the World Tour is bigger than ever. And it's just like a fire hose that's just blasting. Now, like, they have so much choice. They don't care at how many Instagram followers you have. Because the other thing, it's like, I think a lot of them would look at that almost like it's a detractor because they're like, this sport is so, you have to be so focused on it. Like, the amount of effort that you put into running your Instagram account, and look, I don't know anything about that, right? I don't have a big Instagram following at all, but they're going to look at that, like, as far as like, okay, how much effort is this guy putting into running his Instagram account? We would actually rather have him putting that effort into like calorie counting. Like, all the guys use food scales now and they're measuring their calories all the time. And that's real. Like, if you're not the athlete that wants to focus on that stuff, like, you just won't make it at the World Tour level. It's so dialed. And if you're not doing it, it's a meat grinder and you're going to get killed.
What role does food have in this? Because the food's a double-edged sword where obviously we're optimizing for power to weight all the time, but then there's a tricky psychological component to food as well.
Yeah. So I ask this question a lot on my podcast as well. Like, I just trying to like ask the guys, like, okay, because you hear everybody's talking about food scales and stuff. So one area that cycling's changed a lot is like nutrition science, like sports science. Around 2019 is when products like Morton and Betafuel came onto the market. And that's basically like the gas lines to the engine have just gotten so much bigger. So guys can just run it on the red line all day long. It's not about making the engine more fuel efficient now. It's just like, let's go flat out when you have sports science like that. Now everybody's using food scales, but it's not like the same like super anorexic cyclist that you used to see in the generation before. Now everybody's using these food scales to make sure they're fully fueled up for all their training sessions and all their races without gaining weight. So it's not about trying to restrict. It's like making sure the gas tank is full when it needs to go without, yeah, overdoing and gaining weight. So I think it's actually much healthier now because guys are just eating more. Like, guys aren't starving themselves like they used to. So you're not destroying your hormones anymore. I think it's healthier, but it's literally like it's calorie counting from January to October.
Yeah, we got to take Jonas out of that conversation. Obviously, as Greg LeMond on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, his quote, Jonas is the skinniest human I've ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, there's always the freaks, right? But like, you also look at somebody like Sepp. Like, Sepp isn't exactly chunky, but like, you see him, it's like the guy's crushing these huge T-bone steaks. Like, I don't, like, he's so relaxed. Yeah, Sepp is unbelievable, right? But like, so there's some of that, it's like genetics and like physiology, but I think for sure I don't know Jonas at all, but yeah, I mean, there's somebody who's just clearly super dedicated to it. But you look at somebody like Pogacar, it's like, the guy doesn't look like ripped for it. Like, and that's not a knock against him, but like he just looks like a normal guy. Like he doesn't look like the cyclist of like a generation before, 20 years ago. It's like they look very scary, like skeletons on the bike.
How much value would you put in as a Canadian compatriot of yours, Michael Barry's book is aptly titled Le Métier, the apprenticeship, the graft, understanding the traditions of European racing and building on that season after season, much in the same way an apprentice electrician leaves school and goes in, finds a mentor and learns the craft and upskills year on year. Do you think there's still a place for that romance and tradition?
It's interesting. The way I talk about this is if you want to be a pro cyclist, teams are looking for you to have three categories filled. And those three categories are, one, do you have like the engine to race at the highest level? Is there like the physiological talent here? That's power testing, Strava stuff, Zwift racing, all this kind of stuff. Like, is there the athletic talent? Two, do you know how to race your bike? That's the most important one. Do you have race results? That's the only way to prove that. And three, are you going to fit in well with this team? Are you a dickhead? Are you a nice guy to fit in the team? Those are the three categories they look at. As you get older, that standard gets higher to meet. So with the apprenticeship, going back to your question there, if you're very young, like the thing is they're willing to sign these five-year contracts and stuff, willing to develop them, like get guys into their development program and develop them from a young age. So when you're very young, if you're 15, 16, 17, 18, 19 years old, your standard to meet in those three categories is lower because the team understands we have time to develop the other parts. They're just looking for you to have the right ingredients. Do you have the right ingredients here for us to create something? As you get older, you need to show the standard you have to meet is higher in all of those categories.
Yeah.
And I would say the best thing you can do if you want to develop as a cyclist is, this is hard to even give advice on, but I would say like my first year in Europe, I got to race every single week from this, I think the last week of February until the second week in October, all in Belgium, France, the Netherlands, like all these like classic style races. And I learned more in that single year. My development in that single year was more than I'd say like 3 or 4 years combined before. Like you do develop very quickly because if you're just racing in the, you learn the tactical parts of bike racing that way by doing these classic style races, like learning positioning, crosswinds, like where, like just how to read a race during the race. Like that stuff you can only learn by doing it.
I don't disagree with you that that's what teams are looking for. They're looking for data. They're looking for Strava data. They're looking for power data. One, they're looking for, do you know how to race? Looking at your Palmares two, and they're looking if you can fit in. I wonder, are we optimizing for the wrong thing? Because we have no measurable data on who is the best lead out rider in the world. We just don't know. Like this should be an objective question we can answer through big data. Who is the best lead out rider in the world? Me and you could argue for the next half an hour on the merits of Van Poppel versus Morkov, who's a better lead out rider. But there is a factually correct answer to this that it will be easily attainable through big data, but we've yet to measure it. I think we're focused on the wrong thing. We're overly focused on physiological data. And as much as I love Jay Vine, I've had him on the podcast a bunch of times, Jay's a great example. His numbers are freakish. But that's not all there is to being a bike racer. It's multifaceted, and we haven't captured the other facets of it in the same way as we have captured physiological data.
Yeah, and so I think this goes back to why it's so hard if you don't get into the pipeline as a young rider, because like they're looking at this stuff, like they are learning leadouts at a world tour level, at the junior level. So I can look at the junior team for Bora, for example, Otto Ader, which is now like doing this Red Bull Junior Brothers thing. That junior team, like when I've been around them, it's like a world tour team. They are learning those leadout skills at that level. Like they're doing race analysis, like watching video, like an NFL football team is doing, like watching game tape for it. And they're learning it at that level. So by the time they do get to the world tour level, yeah, everything is sped up, but they've already kind of learned these skills at a slow level. It's like in like ball sports, for example, like you're still learning hockey, football, whatever. You're still learning a lot of the plays at the younger levels. Now they're doing that in cycling.
Yeah, but we're just not capturing it. Like if you take a criterium example, you raced a lot in North America. So you look at someone's Palmares and they say, okay, well, they finished in the front split of 20 in a criterium. There's many different ways you could finish in the front split. You could be cruising in fourth wheel for the whole day, or you could be sitting in wheel 80, closing gaps all day long. they're two riders that are differently equipped to take the step up to the next level. But we've no data to capture that. Results don't capture that. Physiological data doesn't capture that.
Actually, they do. So this was new to me. This was new to me. And I actually can't speak too much on this because so the one that illuminated this for me was Dan Bigham. And so he is the super nerd of cycling. And I asked him about this. And because in my book, in the audiobook, there's a podcast with six other pros and Dan Bigham is one of them. And it's just so people get their perspective on it as well. And I asked Dan about this. And like the question was actually more around like, how do you evaluate a rider's efficiency in the bunch? Like, can you see like who is really efficient?
That's essentially what we're trying to do. Yeah,
exactly. And so I asked him about this and he said, yeah, they actually do have a way to do this on INEOS. And he couldn't talk about it so much because it's proprietary and they keep it to themselves and stuff. But they do have, and I was just like joking, like, what do you guys have? Like drones flying around? Or are you like looking at, the way I thought they were doing it was looking at using the GPS, like basically to see like relative, like where you are in the bunch and then just calculating drag and like just looking at your power data and stuff. And they do have software that does this to look at how efficient.
Are we sure though? Because there's so much that's come out with INEOS is bullshit. Like I've had Matt Heyman on the podcast and a lot of the ex-INEOS guys, and they pull the curtain back on how much bullshit there's going on there. Like they've done the same thing that Olaf Bo is doing with the two triathletes, Gustav Iden and Blumenfeld. He's making it look like there's this crazy stuff going on. And then you talk to him, he's like, actually, it's just pineapple juice. We write on the bottle that it's super secret hydration mix and it freaks our competitors out.
There definitely is. So there absolutely is a lot of that that goes on. And at the end of the day, a lot of it is just doing the basic, like that is the main thing, is you just do the basic stuff better than anybody else. And that's one thing I learned from doing like the World Tour camps is there was like a box of supplements and all these like recovery toys and stuff. Guys never touched them. They were just like super boring, laying on their bed all day, like never got used at all. With Dan, like, but he also, like, he does look at this stuff. And like, for example, like he talked to me about thermal load and how they measure that during races. Like I'd never heard of this. Like they're looking at on the Garmins, they have the solar panel to like measure for charging the Garmin or whatever. And they look at that to like, look at your solar efficiency or like your thermal rate or efficiency, whatever, during the race. Like they're looking at stuff like that. And then he's starting to explain to me about how they're measuring the efficiency of riders in the bunch. And I'm thinking like, I've never even thought of this. Like, what are you talking about with some of this stuff? Like, so they definitely are playing with this stuff. And especially, I mean, you look at the helmet that Jumbo just came out with from Giro at the ridiculous TT helmet. It's like, okay, they are pushing
already.
The limits. Like they are trying with some of this stuff. Did it get banned already?
Yeah, it's gone. Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. Got banned. And the Giro one, you know, the sock on the neck that got banned.
Yeah,
the
specialized one. Yeah.
So what are we missing here in this recipe to become a pro cyclist?
You need to have a good team of mentors. I would say getting to Europe is very important. Getting in that pipeline is very important. Learn to enjoy the process because, okay, here's the other thing. On the cover of my book, there's a triangle and it says talent, hard work, and opportunity. And you need a combination of all three of these things. I would say, I think people really overestimate talent. Like you would be surprised at like I said, Matteo is not the best example of this. But for example, like I remember seeing him like physiologically, like he wasn't really that special, but he worked his ass off and made like the most out of the other two. Like he worked so hard, made the most out of the opportunities. And I would say he was like, okay, more than average, but not a freak talent-wise. Yeah. You need to balance these things. And for me, like the overarching lesson at the end of the book was you need to design a life that you enjoy long enough that you're willing to stick around for your opportunities to come around. Because you have to work your ass off. You do need some talent. And you can't just hope that things are going to line up for you. But there's a lot of luck or lack of it in bike racing as well. And you need to be willing to play the game long enough for your opportunity to come around. Because if you bet your whole season on a couple races, you have a crash at the wrong time, you break or you get a flat tire, like that's gone versus getting a result there. Like that could cost you a result that could get you a World Tour contract. And you need to love the life you're living in order to be willing to stick around for your opportunities to show up as well.
Hey, Roadman, excuse the short interruption. I love riding the bike, but on account of being so busy with the podcast at the moment, I'm now what's called a time-crunched rider. I never thought I'd see the day, but I have a tool. I'm using Wattbike to keep myself sharp and on point with specific sessions to maximize that available training time. I have a Wattbike Atom right here in the recording studio beside me. And when I have an hour in between interviews, I jump on. It's removing all the friction points for me. There's no more 10-minute setup, unfolding legs, banging my knees off stuff, getting my hands dirty, the usual connection issues. It just works every single time. The Atom's perfect for virtual racing as well because it has crisp gear changes, it has 1% accuracy, and it has max gradient capability of up to 25%. If you're looking for an indoor trainer, I honestly couldn't recommend this any higher. I've been using a Watt bike since 2013. Honestly, it's the last indoor trainer that you're ever going to need. If you head on over to wattbike.com now and use code ROADMAN10, that's ROADMENTEN, and that's going to get you 10% off your Watt bike. Yeah, even small things like can really improve your longevity, like making an extra 50, 100 euro a week passively somehow online in gig economy. Like I raced for a French team making 50 euro a week. Your accommodation is covered, so that's 50 euro for food. Your race entry is obviously covered. But 50 euro a week is tight on food. Like, so you actually crack because you're hungry and you don't have the money to feed yourself properly, or you're just eating very basic stuff. An extra 50 euro a week really improves your mental health. And that's going to make you stick around for that opportunity to show up.
Yeah. Yeah. And you have to do the thing. I mean, absolutely. Right. Like I think about it the first, like, so I lasted, I'm in my sixth year of being in Europe, but for the first 3 years I was here, I didn't have a car. And so you're doing everything by bike. So it's like, you go training 5-6 hours in the rain, you come home, shower, and it's like, I got to go get groceries now. And like when you live in Austria, that means like backpack hauling the potatoes up the mountain in the rain after that. It's like, man, like when I got a car, that was the best, like in my fourth year, that was the biggest performance advantage I ever had. And it was like a cheap car that I should have been negotiating based on how much gas was in the gas tank. Like it was a really cheap car. But to me, it's like, this is like my Porsche, because it's like, I don't have to pedal it. I stay dry. I can get as much food as I want. And when a spoke breaks on my bike, I can just go drive to a bike shop and fix it. And then I can go training that day. Like that stuff, like, I wish I would have known that earlier in my career. Like you do, I always just had the attitude like, if I just work hard enough, I can manage it. Like I can handle all this stuff. Like I'm tough enough, I can take it. But I wish I would have, I mean, I don't know what I would have done differently, but yeah, having like another 10 grand or something like that, just to make life a little bit more comfortable, it makes a big difference.
How big is the mental components? Have you worked with sports psychologists? Is that something you would advocate?
I never worked with a sports psychologist for it. I really relied on my mentors for that, I guess. I mean, I was big on the mentors. I remember like one thing when my first year in Europe, I wrote two quotes on my bedroom and on my wall in my bedroom in my first year in Europe. And the first one was, if you run into an asshole today, he's an asshole. If you run into assholes all day, every day, you're the asshole. And it was just like, that was my way of reminding myself, like you're in their country, you need to learn, you need to get along with their system. That doesn't really apply to your question, but that's one of the quotes. The second quote was understanding that everybody quits and goes home after their first year. Like you go from Lance Armstrong, Cadel Evans, all of them. You see everybody that goes to Europe, they go to Europe, everybody gets their head kicked in the first year. And then so many of them quit, go home, think they're quitting cycling, take 3 to 6 months off, and then realize actually they still want to be a pro cyclist. And then they go back over and they try. And for me, it was like just realizing, like just skip that stage and get through to it. And I mean, the sports psychology thing, I really just remembered what I learned from Swain is just appreciate this time, you know, live with no, like to give it your best. And yeah, it's appreciate this special time to go after your dream and don't have any regrets when you do hang up your wheels after.
You know, this idea of what's taken me from where I was to where I am isn't the same set of tools to take me from where I am to where I want to go. What do you think is the missing chapter that maybe you're not equipped to write? That takes the step to World Tour. What's the part you've missed? Have you tried to deconstruct that?
I got very close. There was 3 years in my career where I actually thought I was getting a World Tour contract, and then it didn't end up happening. And you find out around Christmas time you're actually not getting a World Tour contract, and that really sucks. So I think I got about as close to making as you can get without making it. And so I think I've seen pretty much all the angles right up until making that contract. Once you're, I mean, I can't speak about what it's like once you're in the show. Like I could probably write a second, if I ever made it, I could write a second book being like how to be a pro cyclist, or be a World Tour cyclist. Maybe could you like rephrase, like, I just want to make sure I'm answering your question. Could you ask the question again?
Yeah, I had a conversation not too long ago with Matej Mohorič, And I can't put my finger on the golden thread that links Matej Mohoric to Fred Roy to Daryl Impey to Matt Heyman. But they have a quality. It's a quality that I don't have. And I'm not sure it's a quality that other people have that haven't made it to the World Tour. It's, you know, the French would call it the je ne sais quoi. It's the X factor. And it's almost trying to articulate what is that X factor? What is that thing that you can take the step from continental to World Tour? Sure, there's some guys, maybe they are continental, that get to World Tour, but then they don't have it and they drop back down. But I think the real stalwart World Tour riders, especially your stars, they all have some sort of binding quality that links them. And I'm not sure what that is.
Okay, so I don't know if there's a specific thing that links all of them, but I've been able to sort of figure out what I was lacking, or like one thing, like I've realized in the last couple of months, one thing that I was really lacking with that. And so a lot of the guys in the World Tour ended up reading my book and sent me a lot of really nice messages after, and that was awesome. And the thing that just about all of them said was, you know, I can't believe this guy didn't make it. Like, how did you not make it? Like, I've never heard of somebody that with like such incredible power numbers, worked so hard, was so focused, didn't quit, did all this stuff. And they mean it like a compliment. And that's the best compliment in the world, right? Like, from the best guys in the world to be saying that, it's the greatest compliment ever. But it also kind of breaks your heart, because the way I'd look at it being like, well, how the hell did I screw this up? Like, I had all the talent. I did everything right. How did I still manage to screw this up? Like, I must be a really big failure to mess that up. And what I've realized is a big thing that hurt me in my career, I'll give you like a hockey analogy, was just gripping the stick too hard. Like, I was so desperate that I have to make it, because at times, like, I'd have to go get like another job. Like, I'd go work construction during the off season sometimes because I needed money in order to fund another year in Europe. And you're basically being a push broom operator on a construction site, and it's horrible. And you're just like, I have to make it as a pro cyclist because I can't do this. And people want to like romanticize this desperation thing, but it's like, maybe that desperation of like being so afraid that you have to make it works in other sports, like combat sports, for example, where it's like 8 weeks leading up to a boxing match. And I'm a huge MMA fan. Like, so like maybe it works in that, but as a pro cyclist where it's like year after year living like that, like for me, it was, I couldn't sleep at night. Like, I couldn't relax. I was so, I would overdo it. Like, I would train so hard because I'm like, I have to make it with this. And I couldn't relax. And then I'd see all these other pros that had made it that I was trying to learn from, whether it's Sepp, Annemiek, like all these people, and they've made it, and they just seemed more calm than me. And I wasn't calm. Like, I was like, I was just trying to twist the throttle too hard. And I thought that's what it was. Now that I have like this, like whatever this book business thing on the side is, it's given me so much more peace, because it's like, now I have another project where it's like, I can use my brain for that. And I'm just more relaxed with it. I'm like, wow, I wish I would have had this during my career, because it gives me that peace to just execute the training properly, but not overstress it. Not grip the stick too hard, like to give a hockey term.
You want my amateur assessment?
Yeah.
I think the piece you've missed from the conversations I've had with World Tour riders, you know, hundreds of them on the podcast and coaches, I think you've neglected the sports psychology part.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Keep going.
I really do. Even that conversation there, the failure to relax, even the identity, you don't see yourself as a World Tour rider. Even some of these guys, like, you know, you could take a Darren Rafferty, who's just stepped up to EF this year. He's been a World Tour rider for 5 years, even though he just signed his World Tour contract this year. That's how he sees himself. That's his identity. You know, Michael Phelps wins his 7th gold by 1/100th of a second. That's not physical. There's nothing physical about that performance. That's an identity. That's a mentality that, no, I don't come second. I'm a winner. I'm a gold medal Olympian. I don't get second. Never. There's a mentality that goes with that. And I think sports psychology is super undervalued. And I think it's something that I've seen a lot of the top guys putting a lot of emphasis on.
That's definitely something I would look into that more, because I think like one thing, I can't give myself any credit for this, it's just like, this is just like how it was, is one thing I think that kept me in the game long enough is, we're talking before about like, you can have all these stats in cycling. Like, you can see your climbing times, your VAM, your watts per kilo, all this kind of stuff. And I had so many people like praising me and telling me that I was going to make it and like that I could be great, that like for my entire career, I could not imagine a scenario where I wasn't doing the Tour de France, the Olympics, the World Tour. Like I was just sure I was going to get there at some point. And that's what kept me in the sport so long, like kept me trying. Cause I'm just like, I'm for sure I'm going to make it. Like I can't quit. Like I'm going to make it. And so I had that, but I guess I was, yeah, I was also just afraid of like, what if I don't make it? Like not being able to live with myself for that. And so I don't know, like if it, maybe it's like, that's the fire that gets you to push so hard, but I think it also burns you a little bit. Like what you were saying, like you just can't relax. Yeah. And now it's like, I'm like, okay, if I don't make it, it's like, I really did give it everything I had. Like there's not one more thing I could have done. And now I've found something new that like, I can be good at something else that doesn't require me to pedal a bike. It's like, I actually love doing that as well. So like, I'll be okay if I don't make it.
Yeah, it's a weird one, isn't there? You get those freak talents. Like I got to chat with Greg LeMond and spent, you know, so many hours with him, which I never thought I would. And just such a unique mind that even the way he never frame it as this binary making it, not making it, he just seen himself as a champion straight away. And obviously you need evidence to back that up, but I think he's seen himself as a champion long before he had ever had the evidence that he was a champion. And it's, there's a humbleness, there's a quiet confidence to it. I don't know how you cultivate it, but definitely he has it. Matej Mohoric has it. There's another couple of guys that I've chatted to, and you can, in a very reserved, humble, non-braggy way, they just carry themselves through their conversation and their demeanor in a different way to the rest of us.
Yeah, it's really interesting because there's definitely guys like that, but I can, on the other side of it, I can also name a handful of like men and women that are some of the very best cyclists in the world. And it's like, they are so insecure and just like, they they don't think they're that great at all. And you're just looking at them like, dude, like look in the mirror, like you're wiping the floor with some of the best athletes in the world. And it's like, what actually drives them is this insecurity of not being good enough. And so I don't know what it is because you definitely get, Michael Phelps, like my job, I stack gold medals or whatever. Like you get that attitude. But then I can think of, well, there's one girl that comes to mind right off the top of the head. It's like, this girl is like so, like insecure in a lot of ways. And it's like, she's unbelievable. Like you're watching her on TV and I'm like, she's so good. And then you're having dinner with her and it's like, she doesn't understand how good she is. And it's just like, how are you not seeing this right now?
Jack, it's a phenomenal body of work. It's phenomenal that you've collated and are able to articulate the lived experiences of, you know, hundreds and thousands of people. You know, that sounds like a lot of people, but it's a very small number in terms of the amount of people that participate in cycling. Only a very tiny fraction of people that ever jump on a bike get to ever live the experiences that you've lived. And you've collated them and aggregated them and articulated them in a way to make that now accessible to the masses and bring them inside this world that only a few people get to experience. It's really brilliant. It's brilliant to talk to you, and I'm delighted for the success of the book. And I'm going to link it below, and I highly advise anyone who's listened to the podcast to pick up a copy, give a copy to your local junior rider, because it's a great story.
I thank you very much. I'm flattered to hear such kind words from you, Anthony.
Thanks for your time, Jack.
Awesome. Thanks, Anthony.
So if you like this video, you should definitely check out this video because I know you're going to love it. And don't forget to subscribe to the channel.